This is Carlin on 98.7 ESPN.
What is the biggest concern for the Yankees in the postseason? We unveil it in moments at 800-919-3776, 800-919-ESPN. It's Carlin with you on 98.7 ESPN. My friends, it is so great to be with you on this Friday night. Ahead of us, we've got plenty of Mets talk in this first hour regarding Michael Conforto and his future here. We have a lot of Jet and Giant talk. We have the locks of incompetence coming your way this evening. And Bob Glauber, Robert Arthur Glauber III. I don't know if that's all true, but Bob Glauber will be joining us later on from Newsday about his new book out with Keyshawn Johnson called The Forgotten First. And we'll just talk New York football with him because at times it feels as if we're contractually obligated. We will get to all of that in short order. And we, of course, would like you to be part of the show at 800-919-3776. Also on Twitter, it's at Chris Carlin. Instagram and TikTok, that guy Carlin as well. I put it out on Twitter just a little while ago, and I've gotten some answers already. And the question is simply this. It's more of a statement that I want you to complete. We're all going to act under the assumption here that the Yankees are making the postseason, okay? And I'm not trying to jinx anything. They win a game or they get one loss, one of those other teams, and they are guaranteed to, at the very least, have a play-in for the wild card. So the Yankees at this point, with their magic number at two, I'll be stunned. It would be an epic meltdown of all time if they're not there on Tuesday night playing in the wild card, especially if it's not at Yankee Stadium. Now, having said that, let's operate in the future for a moment. Your biggest concern, your one concern in the Yankees postseason is blank. Finish that sentence for me. And I'm going to start with just a few thoughts on Twitter to just give you a quick idea about what people are thinking. And again, it's at Chris Carlin over on Twitter. You can answer it there. Darwin Peralta says situational hitting. It's the all or nothing approach. Mark says everyone but Judge and Stanton. Ricky Dawson, their analytics staff. OB1156, Garrett Cole isn't an ace. Taw is saying the reliance on home runs. Inconsistent offense, says JD. D. Robbie checking in with Cole. You know, so right there, just out of those few, you come away with primarily Cole and the Yankees' inconsistent hitting in terms of home run or nothing throughout the course of the last several years. Both very valid concerns. My biggest Yankee postseason concern is Aroldis Chapman. For me, I look at the season that Chapman has had, the fact that he has given up 9 home runs in 55 innings, the fact that after the sticky stuff really became a major issue in June, he wasn't very good for a while, had to be removed from the job for a bit, and while he has regained it somewhat, I think we can understand that Chapman's history in the playoffs does not lend itself to a ton of confidence. Brasso, Altuve, even the Correa double back in 2017, you think about all these things, and you think about his history there, and in particular with the Yankees, and I just don't feel real good about that. I feel better knowing that he has somehow pieced it together a little bit in the second half of the season. But for whatever reason, when he is coming on the mound to close out a wild card game and a one-run game, or he is coming on to you know, get a win in a division series or in an ALCS, he remains my biggest concern. Because I truly believe that at any point, he can absolutely lose control and not know where the ball's going, or he could serve up a slider at the wrong time and it ends up in the seats. And I can't get past the notion that he is somebody that is one of the most dominant relievers in baseball, yet he's not. He is so susceptible to the big mistakes. He is really one of those guys that when you watch him pitch, it feels like the intimidation can actually come through the screen. But as I have discussed before, there is a mentality to him that is rather fragile. It is that of a bully. It is that of someone who wants to intimidate the daylights out of you. Yet if he doesn't know where the pitches are going, or if you clearly are on him and you're standing at the plate and he knows that he's got you or that you got him, he folds up. He folds up and he's easily lost. And in the blink of an eye, it can all be all over. We've seen it happen a couple of times now. I don't know why more people don't really look at that and realize the locking down of games that are inevitably tight in the playoffs have to be more of a concern. With Cole, I get it. The other night did not inspire any confidence in any of us, nor should it. But if you're handing the ball to Chapman in the ninth inning, I'm putting on my seatbelt. Buckle up. My faith level has been lowered remarkably over the last couple of seasons, and in this year in particular. So this is what I want to know. What exactly is your biggest concern with the Yankees in the postseason? 800-919-3776. We put it simply like that. You can answer on Twitter as well, at Chris Carlin. What is your biggest singular concern about the Yankees in the playoffs? In just a little bit, we get to the discussion of Michael Conforto and if he should return for the Mets. And I'll give you the reasons why he should not.
It's Carlin.
Double sneeze. Killer.
On 98.7 ESPN.
Nelson Cruz, 1-0 Rays. Oof. That's number 32 in the season for Nelson Cruz, who, in case you're curious, is 41 years old. I'll tell you what, whatever he's got for a masking agent, it's working. Because I don't know how else he continues to do this like Bonds does. I mean, they just showed him. He let his hair grow out a little bit, and he has got snow on the roof, my friends. And plenty of it. Holy cow. 800-919-3776. We begin tonight with Ron in Chester, New York. Ron, what's going on?
Good. Nelson Cruz must be on the TB12 diet. That's how he's doing his thing.
He looks too big to be on the TB12 diet. What's going on?
That's true. First of all, I just want to give you a compliment. It's not really easy to do a sports show as a single person, not having anybody to play off with, and you're really very entertaining and knowledgeable, and not in that blowhard sort of way that we know who we're talking about. Just so I want to give you that compliment.
Oh, really, I appreciate that really very much. Thank you.
So the Yankees, the biggest problem with the Yankees is their starting pitching. In general, they are going to be facing the best pitching throughout the playoffs should they get any further than the wild card. And after Cole, and I still have some confidence in Cole, there's nobody. You have no confidence in Tyone. Montgomery has never really seemed to be a big-time pitcher to go any length, and they're going to wear out their bullpen completely, the one part that's decent on the team. So that's my biggest concern, is that just don't have any starting pitching to go against versus the starting pitching of the teams they're going to be facing.
Look, I understand it completely. I think it's one of those things that's incredibly... I hate to use the word concerning. It feels like it's frightening. Frightening's the word. You know what I mean? It's one of those deals where it just is kind of lingering and could scare the daylights out of you.
Yeah, I mean, the Yankees were built to bludgeon teams and not sort of worry about it. I mean, they had Cole. Severino is just not ready to become back to becoming a starting pitcher. So if they have any shot of winning, they're going to have to bludgeon teams, and we know that doesn't really work in the playoffs. So as much as I'm a Yankee fan and I'm excited, hopefully, to get past the one-game playoff and hopefully see them go further, I'm just not feeling great about it.
Now, listen, I get it, Ron. Thanks for the call. It's, you know, I feel good. I can't believe this is a sentence this season that I never felt like I'd say, but there's always one or two every year, right? I feel good about Nestor Cortez. I feel like Nestor Cortez is going to give you a chance to stay in a game. But I also look at it, let's talk about a wild card game, for instance. If you're looking at one pitcher of the two likely opponents, either the Red Sox or the Mariners, that's going to bother you of having to face, it might be Nate Eovaldi, right? And I'd have to look. I'm pretty sure he would be on track to pitch in a wild card game for the Red Sox. But that's the one that would worry me a little bit, that could really shut the door on the Yankees, because he does have the history against them. But there's nobody on the Mariners that make me feel like that's the case. I mean, for Pete's sake, Chris Flexen is their leader in ERA and wins at 14 wins and 3.7 ERA. He's done a nice job for him this year, and I'm not knocking the guy, but, I mean, it's Chris Flexen, so it shouldn't really be that big of an issue. But, yeah, any pitcher in any moment can absolutely shut the door on you. And the one that I honestly think would give you the most trouble would be Eovaldi at this point. So Eovaldi pitched on Wednesday. So, yeah, it's unlike he's not going to pitch this weekend. Unless they absolutely need him in relief on Sunday to get in, I don't think he's pitching this weekend. Or if they needed him for a play-in game for the wild card spot, on Monday. That's the best you can hope for, because, like I said, Eovaldi pitched on Wednesday for the Red Sox. How about Doug on Long Island next on 98.7 ESPN? Dougie, what's going on, bud? How are you?
Hey, my friend. How are you, sir? Great show again, and you are holding it down. The last gentleman was accurate in his portrayal of you. You're getting analyzed as you do so much analysis on players. But anyway, for the Yankees, you know what? It's really interesting, because they are really must-see TV. They can be down 7 runs in the bottom of the 7th and win by 3 runs. I mean, they're weird. And you know, I'm not saying this to have you repeat it and say it on the air, but, you know, my brother actually is really good friends with Cole. I don't want people calling him up. You know, not you, but other people calling him up and they listen, because a lot of people listen to you in the league, man. But, you know, he said, Doug, this guy is a dog. He literally is not afraid to fail. He knows he may have a day where he goes and gives up 11 runs, but he embraces that challenge. He said he's like a dog. He's a weird kind of human being, but he's not afraid to fail. And
now,
I love that.
That I get. I mean, listen, he at times, Steve, at times, Doug. At times, Doug, he is tough to watch talk after he pitches in a game, because he's still mentally processing what just happened in a good way or a bad way. So it's almost like he's going through his own analysis of it, and it's not, it doesn't feel like it's healthy. You know what I mean?
No, he's one of those guys
like you're beating yourself up a little bit on things.
He's one of those guys, his wife can't stand it when he doesn't win, you know, because the whole night is going to be horrid. So guys that really wear it on their chin, it's amazing, man. It's amazing. But thanks for, you know, taking the time, and I appreciate you and love the show.
Always good hearing from you, Doug. Appreciate that. Doug, of course, is the brother of Steve Mills, the former president of the Knicks, and always brings good quality material to the show. Tony on the car phone is next on 98.7 ESPN. Hey, Tony, what's going on, bud?
Good. So, you know what? It's hard for me to go against you saying the Chapman. I totally understand your point with the how many blown saves that they've had in the ninth inning. But for me, it's got to be the defense. A game seven, it's a winner, basically game seven, winner-take-all type of thing playing. The defense of the Yankees has been questionable at best. And, you know, look at the play that Sanchez made a couple of weeks ago, you know, the runner coming home from third base that he missed the tag on. You know what? In the game seven, you can't make those errors. It's so hard to overcome those errors. You know, it's only a matter of time before their defense lets them down. Gio Urshela with the same thing, those little errors. It's so hard to absorb those errors in a game seven winner take all. And it's just like you said with Chapman. If there was an error behind him and now he's struggling, it's over.
Let's talk about this for a second, okay?
Yep.
Number one, let's say it's the wild card game, right? And it's Cole.
Yep.
We know Sanchez isn't going to be catching. Now, they may bring him in later to hit, but I'm not convinced that they would let him take over for Higashioka in a winner-take-all type game, especially when it's Cole on the mound, or Kluber, for that matter. Secondly, you know, Gio at shortstop, let's put it this way, and this is not high praise, I understand that. It's at least better than the alternative, no?
So do you like him better than Velasquez?
I liked him better than Torres, you know. Okay. Gio's going to play. You know, Velasquez is not a concern here for the postseason. Now, maybe they'd add him to the roster, but I don't see that.
Do you think that the injury to DJ LeMahieu may force the issue, and what's going to happen with that?
It's hard to say, and thanks for the call. I was just listening to Boone talking before about it, and he had not, and I think this was purposeful, which would have me a little bit worried, he had not talked to DJ before he went and talked to the media before the game today. And I think that was purposeful. Like it's almost one of those things where you want to have the plausible deniability. Oh, well, I hadn't talked to him to hear about what the situation was. So that way he didn't have to lie about it. The hip issue with LeMahieu, look, if that's the case, then yeah, maybe we are talking about Velasquez back up. But I do feel like if LeMahieu can stand on one leg, he's likely to be out there. I'm really hoping that what we've seen with LeMahieu this year has been a lot more about injury that he has played through than anything else. Yankees have tied it up at one, by the way. Stanton, RBI single into right center field. Mike in Hillsboro, New Jersey. Michael, what's up, baby?
How you doing? Good. Appreciate your insight, fan of the show. I'm from the D.C. area, and I'm kind of embarrassed for New York sports right now. The Jets and the Giants are an embarrassment. And Chapman, for all that money, you're not getting what you bargained for. I grew up Gibbs. After Baltimore left, we rooted for the Redskins, and Gibbs came in. And, you know, the Giants, you know, they were awesome. And I don't – see that passion anymore. What's going on with New York sports?
Well, in general, they're not very good. It's not passion.
I know, but like for a Maryland DC guy to root against a New York team, like there used to be pride. There's no pride anymore. Like Garrett Cole with his comments the other day, embarrassing.
We talked about this a little bit last night. Thanks for the call, Mike. It's more about a discussion of why is it that there's not an accountability to it as much anymore.
Exactly.
There's not an understanding that when you take on the challenge of New York, you can't be surprised when you're not playing well and somebody boos.
Hey, it's going to happen in Philly. It's going to happen in Boston. And it's going to happen in D.C. because it's the Northeast. It doesn't just happen in New York. When you take on that contract in New York, you are especially going to get booed, and you should expect it. Why are these guys not expecting this?
I wish I had an answer to that, because it's supposed to be an expectation. Thanks for the call. I just don't know why there is not that expectation anymore. And is, when you look at the larger picture, does that start to become now a real, real deterrent about New York? We've always heard it before with certain players, but overall, with the way athletes today are trained, does it become a much bigger problem? Not trained, with how they come up to just not deal with criticism. They don't handle criticism. And I'm speaking generally when I say that. There are outliers for sure, but they almost look, they just have a wonderment about them when they do get criticized. And that drives me absolutely up the wall. Absolutely up the wall. But I don't know what the answer to that is. I don't know. There is no getting around that it takes a special mentality of player to play here. And we've always known that to be true, but maybe now is the time that we have really maybe grown to appreciate that more.
It's Carlin.
I don't hate. I try to elevate.
On 98.7 ESPN.
When I look at you in your eyes.
You're listening to Chris Carlin on 98.7 ESPN.
I feel like the Jets are going to win this week. Maybe I'm crazy. Maybe I just have no idea what I'm talking about. Maybe I'm just a cockeyed optimist like Billy Mumphrey. Maybe I just really am completely drunk, and that's what happened on a Friday night before the show. However it is, I feel like they're going to win this week, and I feel like Zach Wilson's going to actually start to show some promise this coming week. Why am I feeling this way in particular? Well, I'm feeling this way for a few reasons. Number one, I already told you that A.J. Brown is out this week, as is Julio Jones. So that's certainly going to make a big difference in what the Jets are having to contend with on the offensive side of the ball for Tennessee. Secondly, I feel like, yes, it's Derrick Henry, and he's an incredible player. And that is something that you cannot toss aside, even when you can go with nine-man fronts. The Jets have been decent against the run. Granted, they haven't faced superstar running backs, really, in the first few weeks of the season, as it were. But, you know, they faced McCaffrey, and he did his damage. But he's more of that double threat, right? And he's still out. But other than that, they haven't really had to contend with big-time running backs as of yet. So now, even though you are dealing with a front that for the Jets needs to be much better, I feel like it's a chance to really kind of prove themselves, where for the Titans, there are not a whole lot of other great options on offense that the Jets have to be, frankly, scared of or concerned with. Is there much about Tennessee besides Derrick Henry that you're really worried about with those two guys out? I mean, at receiver, we're talking about some of these names. Nick Westbrook-Ikhine, Josh Reynolds, Chester Rogers, Cameron Batson. Now, the Jets' defense, the secondary, has actually done a pretty good job already. They have done better than we would have anticipated. I think we can all agree on that. But when Tannehill is dealing with that group of players, and, you know, he doesn't have Jonnu Smith at tight end anymore. He's got Anthony Firkser. And their offensive line is not nearly as good as it has been in the past. I feel like the Jets are going to be able to do some things against Tennessee's offense looking to stop them. You know, because when you are lacking those kind of weapons and your offense to begin with is largely predicated on one thing, and that's running the football, even though Ryan Tannehill's been a pretty good quarterback since he's been in Tennessee, it's not at all what they're based in doing. And when you can't do one nearly as well as you used to, and this is a reason why they went out and felt like they were upgrading when they got Julio Jones over Corey Davis, who now is with the Jets, obviously. You know, when you go out and you upgrade like that, you think it's going to make a huge difference. Well, it doesn't when they're not on the field. So you've got them off the field, and then you've got, frankly, a secondary that's just not that great. The Titans this year in pass defense, average at best. They are average at best. Now, they're an NFL defense, which has you concerned, because Zach Wilson is still having trouble with, how do I put it, NFL defenses, right? This is a problem. So while Wilson has not looked great so far, I would honestly give them an opportunity here to really kind of open things up and give him a chance. I don't think they're going to be looking to blow the ball downfield or anything like that. But if the Jets can just keep the football away from the Titans a little bit and not allow Derrick Henry to go nuts, and they can get 8 and 9 in the box to try to stop him, you know, they haven't been a terrible tackling team so far. Like, their defense to me has just, it's been better than I would have expected. It truly has. So when I look at all of those things and I look at the matchups, I feel like this is a time when maybe, just maybe, they can get that first win. Because I just don't believe in the Titans' ability to shut down offenses, especially when their pass defense has not been great. Just looking at what the quarterback rating is against the Tennessee offense, it's near the bottom third of the league. So you're just hoping week to week the kid gets better and better, and whether or not you want to admit it, going from 4 interceptions to the sacks last week that he took because they were his fault, and just 1 interception, it's progress. It's not the kind of progress that you're hoping for, but believe it or not, it's actually some progress. And it's going to be incremental. This feels like a week where the Jets can get it done. 800-919-3776, 800-919-ESPN. One thing I would like to see is that they actually could have a running back take control. And, you know, you get the feeling that the Jets, in playing all three guys with Coleman, with, you know, Ty Johnson and Michael Carter, they're looking for somebody to take control of the job, and nobody really has. Part of it's because of the offensive line, but the offensive line were supposed to be road graders, guys that were going to push it around up front. Jets haven't been able to run the football nearly enough. You would hope that at some point here, you could see one of these guys take the bull by the horns and actually have a big game. And by big game, I'm not even talking about 100 yards. I'd love to see Tevin Coleman or Michael Carter go out there and rush 16 times for 89 yards. Wouldn't that be nice? That's a serviceable game. Ira in Staten Island is up next. Ira, what's going on, bud?
Hey, what's happening, Chris?
And you Ira, how you feeling these days?
I'm feeling just exactly what you just talked about for the last 5-10 minutes. You know, it called me crazy, like you just said about yourself. This matchup, I think, of course, listen, the Titans are devastated with injuries. They got six starters out.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, no Bud Dupree on the defensive side.
Right, they got their punter out. I mean, they had an offensive lineman out. It's a defensive lineman out, a corner out. But with that defense, like you just described with the Titans, if you look, if the Jets don't have self-inflicted wounds, I'm talking penalties and turnovers, if they could play a clean football game and they could keep Zach from 20 and 25 passes and run the ball close to 35 to 40 times, they could win this game. Because you know what? The Titans are going to be one-dimensional. You could cheat and load up on Henry. He's going to get his 100 yards. Just don't let him go for 175 and two touchdowns. And if you could just contain him and control him, the only thing you really got to worry about is RPOs with Tannehill, because Tannehill does have legs and he can move. So I want to see how creative the Titans are going to be. But I think the Jets are going to win this game, just like you said. You know, it's any given Sunday. The Titans are, you know, they're coming in here. They're probably overlooking the Jets. And I think the Jets are winning this game 24-23. Like I said, call me nuts, but I agree with you 100%.
I think there are good things to look at here across the board this week. Ira, I think you used the appropriate phrase, clean game. Just a clean game. You know, just look like you are in control of the offense for the majority of the game. That's what you're looking for from them.
That's right. And if they do that, they're going to win this game. I mean, I don't know how many more they'll win the rest of the year, but I think this Sunday, like I said, no penalties, no turnovers. I think the Jets walk out of there with a win.
Appreciate it, Ira. Thanks for the call. I am so hopeful of it because I so truly do believe they are in an infinitely better situation than the Giants are right now. I just don't think that the Giants can really recover from what has been a disastrous start so far. I hope I'm wrong about that, but I have very little ability to see where the win is coming from anytime soon. And frankly, I have very little hope in believing that it is coming. And I know that these Saints are not the Saints of old, right? It's a lot different. And even, look, Drew Brees wasn't Drew Brees the last year, year and a half. But can you turn over Jameis Winston? It shouldn't be that difficult. It shouldn't be. I understand that he's got Sean Payton and he's better at that now. But frankly, just find a way to turn over Sean Payton, or to turn over Jameis Winston. If you could get two turnovers against him, they'd actually have a chance. We'll get more into the Giants in a little bit, more into all of New York football at 8:30. That is 16 minutes from now with Robert Arthur Glauber. And I don't even know if that's his middle name. I'll ask him when he comes on. Bob's got a great new book out with Keyshawn that is called The Forgotten First. And we will also talk more about everything going on in New York sports.
It's Carlin.
I'm the guy who does his job. You must be the other guy.
On 98.7 ESPN.
The book is a great one. Just out, The Forgotten First. Kenny Washington, Woody Strode, Marion Motley, Bill Willis, and the breaking of the NFL color barrier. Keyshawn Johnson with Bob Glauber wrote this book, and it is out as we speak, available Amazon, wherever you get your books. And Bob, the legendary Hall of Fame writer from Newsday, joins us right now. Robert Arthur Glauber, how are you?
Close. Christopher,
what is it?
Carlin. Christopher, I was at an airport a couple of weeks ago, a Newark airport. I did not see you.
Which was a huge upset, because it's the only time we've seen each other the last 5 years.
That's correct. Correct. How are you, my friend?
I'm great. If it's not Arthur, what is it?
David.
David.
Arthur would have been pretty good, though. Yeah. I told my mother about that one.
David, that's Robert excitingly Arthur. Average.
Well, you know, that's what you get.
Bob, The Forgotten First. Let's talk about this first for a few minutes here. And I love this idea. How did this come to fruition with you and Keyshawn?
Well, you know, I've been thinking about this for a while, Chris. I've been covering football forever, since 1985. And it was only a couple of years ago, I'm literally standing in the Giants locker room, probably waiting for Odell Beckham or some other player, you know, to interview. And I'm looking around the locker room. I'm a curious. I'm a journalist. I want to know how things are, why things are, and you know the NFL is the most diverse sport that there is in terms of its players. And thinking, you know, was it always this way? No, it couldn't have been. And then I go, well, okay, Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in baseball. You know, how did it happen in football? And I literally didn't know. I just didn't know. And I Googled on my phone, you know, first black player in the modern NFL, Kenny Washington. Okay, I kind of felt guilty. I did not know. But I didn't, I think that other people didn't know either, and that's the case. It's just an untold story. And I felt like Keyshawn, you know, I spoke to him about 18 months ago. I've known him since he first started with the Jets, since 96. And I wanted to see if he'd be interested in kind of collaborating on telling this story. And we spoke for literally just a couple of minutes before you could just tell he connected with it. And we connected with it. And part of it was that Keyshawn grew up in LA, played about 10 miles from where Kenny Washington and Woody Strode played when they were kids. And they became the first black players in the modern NFL. He didn't know it. He didn't realize it. And he was kind of blown away. And we both were. So there is a lot of intrigue and depth, and you know, it's a problem story that happened many years ago. Black players were banned from the NFL for 12 years, and it wasn't until these guys in Los Angeles and Bill Willis and Marion Motley with the Cleveland Browns of the All-America Football Conference became the first African-American players in modern pro football. And it's now to the point where the NFL is 70% African-American. Well, it started out as 0% African-American, so it's come quite a ways.
Bob, why do you think it is that we've never paid attention to this before? Because there, I mean, for Pete's sake, there was a movie made about Glory Road, right, and Texas Western in basketball against Kentucky. There have been infinite number of books and movies about Jackie Robinson and such. Why was it that football was not really paid attention to in the same way as far as who broke the color barrier?
It's a really good question, Chris, and the answer is a little bit complicated, but I think you boil it down to football. Pro football was not as big, certainly, as it is today. It was not as big as baseball back in 1946, and this is now the year before Jackie Robinson crossed the color line in pro baseball. So 1946, and this is the 75th anniversary of that season. It's a very important time in NFL history. So college football was king back then in terms of the sport of football. And part of it also, Chris, was it this was not a celebratory event in the same vein as Jackie Robinson. You know, Jackie was signed purposefully by Branch Rickey to the Brooklyn Dodgers. It was, you know, Branch Rickey knew exactly what he was doing. He knew the importance of what Jackie Robinson meant to Major League Baseball and to pro sports and to the country. But, you know, in football, integration was forced on the Rams, essentially. They were forced to sign at least one black player, and that was Kenny Washington, when they wanted to move from Cleveland to Los Angeles and use the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum, a public building paid for with public tax dollars, built by a lot of African-American laborers. So, you know, it was forced on him. The guy who is the Branch Rickey of this story that no one talks about is Paul Brown. You know, Paul Brown is a Hall of Fame coach, the great strategist, Bill Belichick's favorite coach of all time. Bill Belichick feels that Paul Brown is the greatest strategic and, you know, overall head coach in the history of pro football. But it was Paul Brown who purposely signed Marion Motley and Bill Willis, not to say I am the first, you know, coach to sign black players. It's because he wanted good players. And it didn't matter whether they were black or white, and he knew that it was risky, but he did it, and he did it quietly because he didn't want to put any more pressure on these guys, knowing that it was a big deal. So, but Paul Brown, you know, gets the credit for it, and he had no hesitation at all to use these players. And they became Hall of Famers. Willis and Motley were both inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and they were part of one of the great football teams of all time. We talk about the Patriots. You know, the Cleveland Browns were the Patriots before the Patriots were. They dominated the All-American Football Conference for 4 years, and then they dominated the NFL for several years after they were merged into the league. So it's a complicated story. It's fascinating. And Keyshawn and I are just so, you know, we're just so in lockstep in, you know, being passionate about the story and where the NFL came from. It was a really dark time when black players were not allowed in the league, and there were some really unsavory owners, including George Preston Marshall of Washington, who was very open and said, basically, I'll integrate my team when the Harlem Globetrotters sign a white player. And that's wow. That's the mentality that existed back then. So you can imagine how far it's come since then.
Bob Glauber of Newsday and his new book, along with Keyshawn Johnson, The Forgotten First, Kenny Washington, Woody Strode, Marion Motley, Bill Willis, and the Breaking of the NFL Color Barrier. One more on this, Bob. What I guess we've all read about the struggles of others like Jackie Robinson that have gone through this. Were there aspects of this, of what these players had to contend with, that... I mean, I almost used the word surprise you, but I mean, in some ways it would be difficult knowing what the climate of the country was at that point to be surprised by anything, really.
Yeah, they were definitely subjected to racism. And I'll tell you one story where in the first year of the Browns, they played a game in Miami. That team was the Miami Seahawks. And at that time in the state of Florida, black athletes were not allowed to play on the same field as white athletes. So Paul Brown received death threats over Marion Motley and Bill Willis about the possibility of them playing in Miami. Death threats, right?
Wow.
He decided not to take them with him because he was too afraid that their safety would be endangered. And he paid them. He kept them home. He didn't tell them why. He told them after the season the reason why they couldn't play was because they were threatened with death if they were to play. You know, enough said on that. And, you know, Bill Willis once was playing against an opposing player with the Los Angeles Dons. That player had razor blades in his hand guards and tried to use them on Bill Willis. Marion Motley called the N-word multiple times. They were, you know, they white players would try to fight them, and but they purposely had to not fight. Because if they did, they risked, you know, they risked having people say, well, yeah, see, you can't do it. It can't happen. You can't have black players against white players. They fight. And Branch Rickey himself saw in 1946 that Marion Motley and Bill Willis, particularly, could play against opposing teams, and there was not violence. There was a lot of yelling, and there was some, you know, incidents, but by and large, they competed, and it was peaceful. And Ricky actually wrote to Marion Motley, and Motley saved this letter for the rest of his life. He said it really inspired him to see that, and that was a major reason why Branch Rickey felt that the time was right in 47 to sign Jackie Robinson. He felt because football players could get along on a football field and just compete as athletes, the time was right for Jackie Robinson. So this story kind of bleeds over into the story of baseball based on what Branch Rickey saw from the Cleveland Browns. And he grew up in Ohio and played football as a kid.
And 10 things just come to mind out of what you just said. So I do have a couple of more on this.
Sure.
Number one, when Paul Brown was considering who he was going to sign, was it a similar mentality that Branch Rickey had where he knew it had to be the right guy who was going to be able to handle all of the abuse mentally the way that Jackie Robinson did and not lose control when he was, you know, attacked, basically?
There was some of that, Chris. I think most of it, though, with Paul Brown was he believed in their talent, their athletic talent.
Right.
And he had coached both of them, one in the service. He had Marion Motley when he was in the Naval Academy and in the Navy. And then he coached Bill Willis at Ohio State. So he knew their character, and he knew that they would be able to kind of withstand that pressure. So it was a factor, yes. Mm-hmm. I'd say more the athleticism was a factor. And what happened, and Paul Brown was very good in detailing this in his own writings, there was a game early in the first season where the Browns were playing the Chicago team, and a lot of the Chicago players were roughing up both Willis and Motley, calling them names and physically, you know, attacking them. And what happened was the white players on the Browns came to the defense of Motley and Willis, and it was a team bonding experience that Brown himself knew was going to happen because he'd coached black players in high school and then in college. So he knew that transformation from a team standpoint was going to happen, and it did. And he believed that was a main reason why that Cleveland Browns team got closer was because the white players basically can. It was organic. It was not purposely. Paul Brown didn't say, hey, protect our guys. They just did it on their own. It just happened organically. So that was a byproduct of it, and it was a perfect example of, hey, you know what, this really can work, and there are major positive benefits for the team that has the black players, that they get to know white players, they get to know them as people, and it's remarkable. You know, Mike Brown, I got a chance to talk to him, the owner of the Bengals. He remembers those days as if it were yesterday, and he knew that it was different. He knew that this was an important milestone, but he got to know them personally, and it was some of the best times of his life. And it wasn't until Paul Brown was well into his 70s and maybe 80s when they were driving to the scouting combine in Indianapolis, and you know, they were talking about this, and Paul Brown, he didn't make a big deal out of it. He's not a civil rights icon, and he wasn't doing it to become a civil rights icon. He was, and he told his son Mike and his brother that, no, I did it because they were football players, and I just believed in giving people an opportunity regardless of what they looked like or what their skin color was. And, you know, obviously today that's, oh, of course. Well, back then, that was a big deal, and that was a big step to be taken. But he didn't want credit for it, and he kind of noticed that Branch Rickey did like the credit. Branch Rickey was very much into, hey, I'm the guy that, you know, helped break the color barrier because of, you know, my guts. But Paul Brown quietly had the guts to sign black players when others didn't.
Awesome stuff. I love this. The Forgotten First is the name of the book. Keyshawn Johnson and Bob Glauber about the breaking of the NFL color barrier. Bob, I think because I almost feel contractually obligated, we have to talk about football here.
0-6, baby.
Yeah, we are rolling.
Yeah.
I guess the first question is how?
Well, or how?
How?
Or both.
How are we? Let's start with the Giants, Bob. How are we here?
Okay. We're here because, A, I really do believe that Joe Judge needed to play his players during the preseason. I'm not going to harp on it too much, but Daniel Jones needed more than one half of football to get ready for the regular season. His starters needed to play. You know, if Tom Brady needs the preseason to knock the rust off, a Giants team that finished dismally last year after a decent midseason run needed to get ready. And, you know, you're coming out of the gate, you're playing three winnable games, and you're basically not ready in week one. You make mistakes that, you know, they're not supposed to happen with a disciplined coach in week two against Washington. And then you just cannot put the ball away in the red zone against Atlanta, and you see a lead fritter away, and you lose it at the gun at the bell again. So that's how we're here, and that's why we're here. And, you know, they're staring down the barrel of seven straight games against winning teams, and this has a chance to really get away from them in a terrible way.
You know, I hate to put the cart in front of the horse, but because of those mistakes that you're talking about, Bob, and the fact that they, in a lot of instances, are making losing plays as opposed to winning plays, do we see a situation where John Mara is really, as much as he doesn't want to be this guy, as it's turned out over the last several years, where this is a complete wiping of the slate clean and really evaluating how they're doing things and trying to find someone that has already done it before?
That's a good question, Chris, and I think that there's going to be a temptation to do that. Now, someone who has done it before, you mean like it wouldn't be Parcells? He's not going to do this.
No, I mean, I'm looking around the league, Bob, and I'm, you know, I'm just throwing out a name because of the relationship between the two families, and I've heard that, you know, maybe Kevin Colbert wasn't going to stay in Pittsburgh long term. Somebody like that, or an executive who may have just built an organization that is at least consistently pretty good, and maybe even they have to trade for him. I don't know, but. Not trying to consistently find the next guy, I guess, is my point.
Yeah, no, that's a fair question. And I think Dave Gettleman would be the guy on the hottest of hot seats right now, because I don't think John Mara, in his heart of hearts, wants to make a change at head coach. Yeah. He truly, when he hired Joe Judge, he truly believed that this guy was going to be able to be his coach for 10 or 15 years. This was his Bill Parcells. And, you know, it looked pretty good. Midway through last year, they recover from the 0-5 start. They get back into the playoff race, albeit in a terrible division, but they're there. And then they wilt at the end with a couple of really bad losses. But, you know, you have to look at, you know, the personnel on this team is just not good enough. The offensive line has been a mess from the start. Daniel Jones has actually been, you know, the least of their problems. He's playing, you know, decently. He still may not be a great quarterback. I don't think he is going to be a great quarterback. So Kevin Colbert is a very intriguing name that you bring up, and he's got a great track record in Pittsburgh. I think he's one of the most underrated and excellent general managers in pro football, and I don't know that the Steelers would want to let him go. I don't know that his time with Mike Tomlin has run its course, but that's a name that would absolutely have to be under consideration if – there is going to be a change made at the general manager position. And
all right,
quite
Bob,
frankly, Chris, if it keeps unraveling, there will be a change there.
Bob Glauber, Newsday with us. All right, we'll shift over to the Jets here.
To
me, this is just all about Zach Wilson right now. And I understand that there are other parts of them that are not performing well. But until he plays, just finds a way to play some more disciplined football through these lumps that he's taking, you're going to have games like last week. I still feel like this is not as bad as it looks, and they're not as bad as they look just because of what's happened with him so far.
Well, you know, it's hard because you've got to let the thing, you know, unfurl. I mean, you just have to let the cake bake, and it's hard to do that. It's not ready to come out of the oven just yet. They're just not ready. It's early. And he's played three games, and he was booed in his first home game, for God's sake. So there has to be, you know, the benefit of time has to be given to some degree. Now, that said, yes, they have to show some, some things right now, and Zach Wilson has to get, you know, boring, as Robert Saleh likes to say. Just take what's out there. Don't force it. Don't try to be the hero on every play. And it's hard when you're a great college quarterback, you're making these acrobatic plays week in and week out, and this is what got you to be the second overall pick. All of a sudden, you got to change your game. But he's a really bright football mind. I think Zach Wilson is relentless in his preparation. He sees the game really well. I think he's got the arm talent. I think he's going to be a really, really good quarterback. But it's going to take some time. And it's also, you know, he needs better blocking. The offensive line has not been good enough. He needs the threat of a running game to get a play-action passing game going. And he needs more consistent production from his wide receivers. Corey Davis has got to emerge as a number one guy. And we'll see what Denzel Mims has this week. You know, he can stretch the field a little bit. So, yeah, the pieces are there. And I think it is a matter of time. And Robert Saleh was saying today that, you know, once you see it, once it clicks for Zach Wilson, you'll see why we picked him number two. I agree with that. But I don't know that that's going to happen this week, next week, or even next month. It does take time.
Robert, I'll just say it. I miss us. I miss you and me.
I miss us.
Yeah.
I love us, Chris.
And I mean, can't.
Listen, I don't want to get weird, but, you know, listen, we go back a long way, my friend. We go back to the dungeon in Giant Stadium, okay?
Yes,
with
we
those
do.
Disgusting stains on the carpet and, you know, the payphone in the corner. I sound like I'm, what am I talking about? But
I, no, I remember.
Room, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. It was,
oh, my God. I remember, Bob. And yep. Put it this way. I look forward to running into you at Hudson News in Newark Airport the next time I'm going in to buy my family-sized bag of combos.
Look,
Bob, why do they never
it,
have
man.
The single size of combos? They always have the big size of Pringles and combos in the damn stores in the airport. Just give me the normal size, Bob.
I know. That is weird because they're gouging. Of course.
Exactly. Another way, they're sticking it to you, Bob. All right, that's
said.
That's right. The book is The Forgotten First. You have got to check it out. Kenny Washington, Woody Strode, Marion Motley, Bill Willis, and The Breaking of the NFL Color Barrier. It is out now, Amazon, wherever you can get it. Bob Glauber and Keyshawn Johnson. We'll talk again soon, my friend. Thanks.
Thanks for having me, Chris. Great chatting.
Appreciate it. He's the best. As good as it gets, and I didn't even get a chance to say, and I should have said this, Bob got into the Hall of Fame this year, which was just absolutely awesome.
You're listening to Chris Carlin.
Yeah, like I'm the Gordon Gekko of fat guys.
On 98.7 ESPN.
Yankees down 2-1, bottom six to Tampa. We saw earlier in the game, and I wonder if it's not a close game at some point this weekend. We saw earlier in the game, Nestor Cortez threw one very, very high and tight at Kevin Kiermaier. It is amazing how much these two teams hate each other. It is, frankly, it's fantastic how much these two teams hate each other. So we saw that, but it's in a 2-1 game, that's not going to happen. But at the same time, boy, Yankees down 2-1, Red Sox up 4-0 on the Nats. Bottom six. Don't do this. Don't do this. All right. More importantly right now, you and I, we have work to do. Calls at 800-919-3776. 800-919-ESPN. My friends, we are getting in a moment to our weekly segment that produces joy and pain. Maybe even some sunshine, maybe some rain. It is the time of week when we give you our selections based solely, not in fact, but in odd fact. Each week, we make our football selections based on weird facts involving one of the two cities involved in a particular matchup. Why do we do this? We do this quite simply because I am the worst prognosticator of games in the history of National Football League selections. The worst. I've done it based. In fact, I've done it any which way you can. None have worked. So now we present week four and the locks of incompetence.
He's tried everything. Analysis. Instinct. Facts. Coin flips. Magic eight balls. Scientology. If picking NFL games is right, you can count on him to be wrong. It's time for Carlin's Locks of Incompetence.
2021 overall record stands at 5-7. A little 3-1 week to get us back into it after a rough 2-6 start. Yet here we are, ready to roll. Game one features your New York Giants headed down to New Orleans to take on the Saints. The Saints are 7-point favorites at the Caesars Superdome. Did you know that a New Orleans dentist, Levi Spear Parmley, invented the first form of dental floss? Spearmint, anybody? Saints minus 7. Game one. Game two. The Tennessee Titans visit the 0-3 New York Jets. The Titans are 6-point favorites at MetLife Stadium. Did you know that it is not illegal to go topless in New York? That's a spicy meatball. Jets plus 6. Game three. The 3-0 Cardinals visiting the 3-0 Rams. The Rams are a 4-point favorite in a showdown of undefeateds in the NFC West at SoFi Stadium. Did you know that in Los Angeles, there is a law against licking frogs? The law came in power after some teenagers in Los Angeles found out that a certain type of toad skin contains hallucinogens. Rams minus 4. And finally, Miami. The 0-3 Colts visiting the 1-2 Dolphins. Miami 2-point favorites at Hard Rock Stadium. Did you know that snow was only once recorded in Miami in 200 years? It came on the 19th of January, 1977. Dolphins minus 2. Your locks of incompetence for week four. 800-919-3776. 800-919-ESPN. We are back in it after going 3-1 this past week and elevating our record now to 5-7 through 3 weeks. That's where we are. Let's hit Buddha in the Bronx, who has been waiting for quite some time. Buddha, what's going on, baby? How are you? Sorry for the wait.
Hey, what's going on? No problem. The wait was well worth it. That was a great interview there, man. You know, my pops was born in Columbus, Ohio. He used to talk to me about Marion and Moose Motley all the time. You know, that was one of his favorite guys. Him and he used to talk about this other guy named Dick Night Train Lane. I had to do some research on that cat. Listen, you know, this dude, Night Train Lane, I don't know if he still holds the record for interceptions in the season. I think he has 16 interceptions in the season. And they were throwing the football like 8 times per game back then. You know, you guys are great players, trailblazers, man, you know?
Well, listen, I'm being honest with you. I have not read the book yet, but I have talked to people who I respect who absolutely love it, say it's an amazing read, and I just got it, so I am picking it up. And frankly, Bob is just one of the greatest guys and writers in this town when it comes to football, so I'm very excited to read this.
Yeah, I think I'm going to purchase that myself.
I appreciate that.
Listen, I'm going to tell you something, though. You're not going to believe this. You're in full lockstep tonight, man. I can't believe it, man.
Really?
Yeah, with these Jets.
What happened?
You know, I'll tell you what happened. First of all, you know, for all the Joe Douglas apologists and everything, I apologize for being so rough on him. I know there's a couple of people that irritated yesterday. But listen, when that report came through about Dupree, Julio Jones, and Brown not playing, that changed the whole perspective of this game. I mean, I was spoke before about how Tannehill could be an RPO option. That could be a problem. But basically, this game is going to come down to if the Jets are going to be like in that commercial where Derrick Henry is carrying everybody through town and running with them on the treadmill, they're going to lose the game. And he's going to probably have the single-game rushing record because they don't have much else to put out there. But I don't think that that's going to happen. And
actually concerns me a little bit about it, and this is bizarre, but hear me out, Tannehill's ability with these RPOs to run the football. Because he's actually been effective in doing that.
They have to be careful with that. They definitely have to be careful with that.
Yeah.
But what I'll say is this. It's a simple path to victory, and it's a doable victory. I mean, I got to be honest with you. The Carolina game, the second half, that was the best football that Wilson's played and the best coaching that LaFleur has played. They need to go back, dig through those tapes, see what worked. And then, you know, specifically, you said something also earlier, and it's true. I mean, Michael Carter needs to grab this lead running back spot, you know, by the throat and take it. He's the most talented back they have there. I'm done with Ty Johnson dropping passes, missing blocks. I mean, we got to move on from that. Tevin Coleman, he's a good scat back, you know, but Carter's got to take hold of that running back slot. But the key to the Jets game, honestly, and there's a factor that nobody brought up really. You know, Sam Darnold, when he was here, when he was playing bad, there was always one player that he could go to and depend on and would help him out. And he's been out for 2 games, and that's Crowder. Because, listen, he's the best wide receiver the Jets have. But he also, one thing that he does that none of the Jets wide receivers do, unless we see what happens with Mims, is he gets open. He knows what those pockets are in the middle of the field to get open, and he's sure-handed.
You know, most of the time, he's in a situation where, Buddha, he is a mismatch for whoever is covering him, and thanks for the call. Like, he's got real good chance out of the slot to make an impact, and I think that's a great point by you. It hasn't been talked about as much. You know, Jamison Crowder, for one reason or another, injuries and such the last few years, we haven't seen the full-on best of him, but when he's been out there, we have seen a good amount that would lead you to believe in him. So you would hope that he would be somebody, because the Jets don't have that tight end that you really can use as a safety blanket for Zach Wilson, you know, maybe that can be more of Jamison Crowder.
It's Carlin.
I'm going to complain about judging a quarterback. That was my wife texting me.
On 98.7 ESPN.